Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to all. Today, we have a very important topic to discuss. My name is Kat Usita. I am Deputy Head of Research at HomeFIF, and this is a topic that's very important to us. So in today's discussion, we're going to talk about how the economic fallout from COVID-19 is affecting men and women differently. We're also going to cover how different organizations have been affected and how the pandemic might be worsening inequalities in the workplace that had already been existing before. I am so pleased to say that today's panel is really an excellent roster of speakers. I will begin with Ratna Sahai, Deputy Director of the Monetary and Capital Markets Department at the International Monetary Fund. Ratna, the topic of crises and policy response, this is something that's not new to you. You do a lot of work on that in the IMF, and you have also done plenty of research on the important issue of access to financial services. Can you maybe describe some of the challenges that women might be facing during this time in terms of access to financial services and how the pandemic is impacting that?
Kat, thank you very much for the nice introduction. I really want to thank HomeFIF. So let me tell you that, of course, we've been monitoring. I belong to an organization which has 190 member countries, so we are closely keeping track of the developments there. So let me tell you what we are seeing. I think, as many of you might be aware, the pandemic has already had a pretty regressive impact on gender equality. Women have lost jobs at a disproportionately higher rate than their male counterparts. So I would say about close to 1 million women, and that was maybe even a few months ago, have lost their job. And the majority of them worked in temporary and part-time positions and left the labor force. So I'm sorry to see that with no policy action, this trend will wipe out all the progress we've made in the last decade towards gender equality. And what we had seen is a lot of catch-up. So there are several reasons why women are affected more. They tend to work in social sectors, physical face-to-face interaction. They tend to operate more in the informal sector, and they also tend to do more unpaid jobs than men. And then during the COVID, they're facing other special challenges. So there has been a rapid adoption of digital financial services, which is accelerating during COVID. And even though it has the potential to really close gender gaps, cross-country data indicate that women on average have a lower chance of owning a mobile phone or even a traditional financial account. They have less access to internet. They are less educated. They are poorer and less likely as it is to be in the labor force relative to men. They are also facing violence or rejection by their own families during the COVID crisis. And now they are bearing the brunt of family care responsibilities, which is resulting from the shutdown measures. In many countries, they are the main source of livelihood. So for a number of factors, the COVID crisis has actually hit them pretty hard.
Thank you, Ratna. That's a really broad view. You touched on several aspects, employment, access to services. I'm now going to move on to Deputy Governor Fernanda Nequio of the Banco Central do Brasil. Welcome, Deputy Governor. So you, as part of your job as central banker, you keep a close eye on how the crisis is affecting different sectors of society. How has the pandemic affected women in Brazil? What does the data tell us? What sort of trends are you observing?
Thanks for the invitation for being here. So I think a lot of what I have to say about that reflects what Ratna just told us. You know, women were disproportionately affected by COVID in Brazil as well. This, I think it's going to be true in many countries. But, you know, the statistics that we have so far show that the unemployment rate raised twice as much for them relative to men. So I think we can think about some reasons for that. First, you know, I think women in Brazil, at least in the labor market here, work. A larger share of women working in the service sector or sectors that are contact intensive, And so, you know, those are disproportionately affected by COVID-19. It is also true that a significant share of women work in the informal sector in Brazil, which is a challenge for emerging economies. And the informal sector was also disproportionately affected. And we also seen the statistics that, you know, this disproportionate increase in the unemployment rate for women was more concentrated in the north and northeast of Brazil, which tends to be areas where you have lower income households. So you do see it's almost like a perfect storm, and women can be very damaged by those factors. So I think the other type of statistics that we've seen recently that are interesting to mention is that in Brazil, there has been a survey collecting information about household chores. And you see also that women had the number of hours in household chores increasing relative to men since the pandemic hit the economy. So putting all that together, I think the type of statistics that we are seeing now for Brazil go very much in line with what Ratna was telling us about what is happening worldwide.
That's a very interesting point, the statistics that you have on the hours of household chores, because I think that's something we've all observed in one way or another in our own homes or with our friends or colleagues, anecdotally, but it would be good to see what those numbers might look like. So, Fernanda, you talked about the experience in Brazil. I'm going to move on to Qatar Eddamani of Barings. As Managing Director for Emerging Markets and Sovereign Debt, this discussion of what's happening in emerging markets must be not new to you, and I'm sure you follow closely what's going on in the markets that you cover. Perhaps you could give us some insight on how women could be experiencing the crisis differently depending on the economic environment that they're in.
Yes, so thank you so much, Kat. Hello, everybody. I'm very happy to be here today with you. So I'm not a development policy expert, but I observe the markets that we look at very closely. And I think the observation by both Ratna and Fernanda underline two important things. The first one is that any shocks, here it's a major shock, it's a pandemic, but any shocks tend to magnify existing inequalities. And so if, for instance, women are the category that suffer the most from poverty or from health inequalities or from education inequalities or from participation in the labor market that is lower or of lower quality, in that case, of course, the pandemic will affect them more. And the second thing, of course, is that there is a risk that this pandemic creates even more inequalities going forward. For instance, if you observe the channel of education, if you have, because of, you know, inequalities of access to remote education or the difference that we were mentioning before inside the household of, you know, either, you know, chores or inequalities or, you know, the difference, especially in emerging countries, between access to going to school or remote teaching, in that case, it might lead to more dropouts. It might have much longer lasting consequences on the potential of all these little girls and therefore women in the future. So in general, we can see that the shocks are likely to affect more women because of the existing inequalities. And of course, the problem is that the governments also are not the same, are not equipped in the same way to respond to the pandemics. So, for instance, we have seen some governments expand the support fiscally or in monetary policy or in various ways to their populations in terms of social support, but the governments are not equipped in the same way. They don't have the same financial resources. The IMF has provided a number of financial support facilities, rapid financing to a number of countries, but countries do not have the same resources, and therefore, here is the same. The poorer countries or the countries that are likely to be most affected have the least financing resources to address you know, this social impact, in particular on women. So that is what we are seeing, and therefore I think that continued support by the international financial communities, either through international donors or, you know, all the actors in the international financial sphere, is very important for these developing countries to muddle through the whole crisis.
Thank you, Kautar. That's really an interesting point. I mean, in the same way that the crisis is affecting every household differently, every part of a country differently, every government also has a different capacity to implement supporting mechanisms. And we'll get to all of that in a bit. But I would first like to welcome Gina Omolon from Mazars. Gina, you are a partner in Mazars, and like many of us here today, you have to balance your responsibilities at work alongside your own duties in your household with your family. Can you give us your own observations, whether that's from your own experience or what you're seeing around you?
Thank you, Kat. I am hearing from my fellow panelists a consistent theme. I think we are all in agreement that the pandemic that we're facing right now is an issue that disproportionately impacts women. Although I can still say that when the pandemic started, we were all locked up in our room, whether you're a man, a woman, a child, or elderly, we were all in this together without our usual support systems, right? But if we really look at it with a gender lens, we can see the disproportionate effect on women. In the U.S., a research published by the McKinsey Group and Lean In organizations that they published this year, where they surveyed more than 300 companies in the U.S. and Canada, and also more than 40,000 employees, it revealed that 1 in 4 women are considering downsizing their careers or leaving the workforce as a result of this crisis. I would not have believed that if I heard that in January this year, right? And the key challenges that we are seeing, and you know, we've been hearing also around, and it's really the anxiety, right, over layoffs and furloughs, the burnout that people are experiencing due to the various responsibilities, their workplace responsibilities and expectations, as well as the responsibilities at home with childcare and homeschooling. And then there's this physical and mental health issues that we're all seeing as well. Now, even before the pandemic, the women already have been experiencing the heavier burden. And it's just the norms in our society where women are historically more likely than men to take on these caring roles. You know, think about the mothers, your aunts, and the women in your life, you know, who after working, they would look after the kids or maybe bring the aging parent to the doctor. And also on the practicality side, more women are still earning less than their male counterparts. So, you know, when this pandemic hits, it is expected that they are to be more flexible than their counterparts when decisions need to be made about who should stop working to take care of their family. So as mentioned by Kautar, I totally agree. This pandemic has magnified this existing inequality in our society. In Mazars, when we checked in with our, you know, some of our men partners in the firm and asked them about how their homeschooling is going, because everybody's pretty much in the same boat. Interestingly enough, you know, most of them said, oh, my wife does that, right? So when we all look around us, we see similar trends.
Yep, that's exactly what we're going to do next. Thank you, Gina. Those are some very important points. So I will now pivot to the solution side of the discussion. So we've identified a lot of trends. We've identified a lot of problems that we've seen were worsened because of the pandemic. Let's start talking about what solutions should we be exploring. So speaking about solutions, first maybe let's discuss it from a macro level in terms of what governments or what the public sector can do. So Fernanda, you work in the central bank. What do you think governments should do to ensure that policy responses are inclusive and aligned with gender equality goals?
So this is a very interesting question. The first thing I think to think about is that policies should be better targeted to the challenges that we're going to face, whatever response to shock that we have, right? So I think I can talk a little bit about the experience at the central bank, and then I can go back to the COVID and use it as an example to the type of policies that governments can have to try to better target and better reach minorities when facing a shock. Well, at the central bank, we've had, you know, a very holistic approach to integrating and make sure that we have a safe and productive environment for minorities, women, for example. Over time, we have had several events and workshops in trying to bring awareness and talk a lot about how we want to have a safe environment to foster diversity and how to guarantee that we have women included in the discussions and in the several layers of the administration and the work at the central bank. We actually this week have been working on a week to discuss financial literacy, which is something that it's not targeted internally, but targeted to the general public in Brazil. This is, I think, is a very important topic, particularly because, you know, statistics show that some women are left behind or even outside the financial sector. So we have been in a campaign to promoting financial literacy in Brazil. And this is something that the Central Bank of Brazil has been very keen on and working very, very much. I can talk later about also initiatives that we have been having on the own sustainability agenda. And by sustainability, we have been talking about mitigating social and environmental risks. And a lot of emphasis have been put on the environmental risks, but social is also key there. And it gets exactly into the point of guaranteeing that we have a safe and an inclusive work environment. So I think policies that go into that direction go straight into the mandates of central banks. And that's something that we should continue to work on. So about now, that's kind of like talking about a little bit policies within the central bank framework. Now, your question was more targeting governments and what they can do in terms of policies. I think, you know, better targeting policies is the way to go. For example, in the case of COVID, Brazil implemented one of the largest income transfer programs in the world to support families during the lockdown or the restricted mobility period. This program was rolled out in April and it reached, you know, 67 million beneficiaries in Brazil. Interestingly, in this program, there was some heterogeneity in the amount of transfer that households would receive. And households headed by women received actually higher transfers than households headed by men. And that was something that, you know, was embedded in the program and trying to, I think the objective was to go into the targeting objective that I mentioned before and taking into account the different needs that poor households have depending on who is the head of the household, right? So I think this is one example that would be a way of better targeting social policies in response to a crisis, which was what we had now with COVID-19. Now, I think in general terms, what we have been hearing from all other, you know, from other countries and internally as well, is that there is a demand for a recovery from COVID that is more sustainable and inclusive. And the inclusion part, it goes straight into the including minorities and poor households, right? So the pandemic, if there is anything positive about it, it raises a discussion about sustainability and the awareness about the need for inclusion with concerns related to minorities, women, and other groups. So many countries right now are discussing basic income programs and constructing green friendly agendas, and those are, you know, coming as a response to the crisis, but I think they can very much so contribute to this discussion about having better targeted policies that could foster the inclusion of women in the economy.
Excellent, Fernanda. That's very useful. Indeed, targeting, policy targeting is very important across all levels, whether you're approaching it from the side of the government or as a central bank, or even within your own organization. And we'll talk about that a little bit more later. I'll move on now to Ratna. Ratna, you're not in the public sector, but you do work a lot with government. So maybe you can give us some perspective there.
So on your question, you know, what governments can do so that the policies are inclusive. So an obvious one is, of course, fiscal transfers or tax benefits to families with small children, because women predominantly take on childcare responsibilities and other forms of unpaid work, which is, as you know, especially burdensome in the COVID era. But then this brings me to my second point. So when it comes to government support for women, they really should have direct access to the infrastructure that is necessary to receive support during social distancing. So if a woman doesn't have a bank account or a mobile phone, what good would a stimulus check be to her? This is where digital finance can really help. So how can it help? One way that we are thinking about is the distribution of consumption vouchers through fintech platforms, which can be complemented by vouchers with income support measures tailored to women beneficiaries, as we just heard in the case of Brazil. And these benefits can be transferred directly, either through the bank or even a mobile money account. Let me just give you a few examples from around the world. And this was actually a study conducted by the UN. So, you know, I had mentioned earlier the challenges. And what we are seeing also is that women who are facing violence or rejection by their own families in countries like Bosnia, Herzegovina, they've developed a plan to support civil society organizations which are running shelters. Colombia, Sweden have made resources available to support gender-based violence survivors. And then women who are the main providers of childcare, Argentina has increased monthly child allowance payments, and Australia and Costa Rica, interestingly, have ensured that childcare services remain open during lockdown. Australia, Cyprus, Italy have granted additional family leave to affected working parents. You know, Canada, Spain, Korea have introduced cash benefits for parents for school and daycare, where they face school and daycare closures, for example. And then, of course, they are the main source of livelihood. So in countries like Togo, Georgia, and Morocco, they're providing cash transfers or grants to women entrepreneurs and, you know, also informal traders. But we also know that many of these countries are very much fiscally constrained. And that's why, you know, the IMF, as Carter very rightly pointed out, we really stepped up financing very fast. So far we have provided emergency financing to about 76 countries. And if you have other types of financing, about 81. There have been grants given for the poorest 29 countries. The G20 is calling for bilateral debt relief, as you know. Also, we provided big liquidity support. Policy advice is to every country, and then capacity development, special things we have done, we've provided during this period to over 160 countries.
Okay, thanks, Ratna. Actually, both you and Fernanda touched on the importance of financial inclusion and financial literacy. I should use this opportunity to plug a report that OMPIC just released today. Actually, it's on financial inclusion in the Asia Pacific and how cloud computing is enabling that. I'm going to switch over to Kautar now. So to change it up a little bit, in your line of work as an asset manager, maybe you can give us some perspective and tell us about how you are incorporating gender equality and diversity goals in ESG investing. What is your take on how this important topic of gender equality and diversity can be integrated in someone's investment activities or an institution's investment activities?
I think that ESG is like the big fashion at the moment. Now, I deal with sovereign debt, which means that my area of expertise is debt that is issued by governments and the public sector. And so as much as, you know, you can do a lot of things in terms of incentivizing or penalizing an issuer or a company when it is a private sector entity. So if you are the shareholder or a debt investor, in a company, you can have very strict requirements, including in terms of gender diversity, for instance, representation of women on boards, and other such factors. I think that we have to be quite cautious when dealing with governments. I think that investors have to have a cautious and humble approach, if I may, in wanting to impose any priorities that they have on governments and penalize them if the governments do not have the same priorities. And it can be in terms of gender priorities, it can be in terms of environmental priorities, it can be not lending to a country because some investors assess that they don't do enough efforts on fighting deforestation, or I don't know. There are lots of debates around these issues currently. However, I think that there is space for incentivizing governments, so more the carrot approach than the stick approach. And in that spirit, you have seen the development of targeted instruments that can help governments who structure willingly and, you know, from their own choice, structure projects around these priorities. For instance, you have had the development of the green bond industry, including for governments recently. I think that the latest issuance was by Egypt was an interesting example in that space. And I think it's the same for gender, for a gender approach to these type of instruments. For instance, if a government decides to issue a bond that is focused on decreasing gender inequalities or addressing specific issues that women face, either on the education dimension or in the health dimension, and they structure it in a credible way, and they do it in accordance, for instance, with objectives of you know, sustainable development goal. We have seen some issuance of SDG bonds, so-called SDG bonds, and investors want to contribute and want to lend money to the governments for financing these projects. I think this is a very interesting way to go. And I think that this is something that definitely will grow as an area of investment. The last thing I want to say is that I think there are some areas where investors can work with governments where they have aligned interests and which will serve directly or indirectly the purpose of decreasing gender inequalities. For instance, there is a lot of work being done around improving transparency of national statistics. It includes fiscal data, monetary data, balance of payment data, often with the assistance from IMF, World Bank, and other international partners. And I think this is something that can be very important. Fernanda was mentioning earlier the importance of targeting some support to women who are most affected, or categories or minorities who are most affected by these type of shocks. We can't do it in a good way if we don't have the right statistics. How much women are more affected by men on unemployment, on poverty, on health or education. So we can see here that if a government makes efforts in improving its national statistics infrastructure and publish more reliable data, so it will serve the interests of the government, of investors, of women, of international organizations, of the civil society, and it can lead to a virtuous cycle. This is just an example. So,
thank you, Lada. Fernanda, do you want to share more?
Just want to add something to what Kapoor just said, which I think is really important. The importance of having data, good data, to assess the challenges that we face. And because we started talking by COVID, I think the COVID experience so far, this is the greatest challenge, right? We do have a lot of policies in place, both from the fiscal side and monetary policy side. And these policies are such that, you know, some people are being able to keep their employment throughout this period because of these policies, and while we wait for the economies to reopen properly and or a vaccine to be in place. And this is all great, but the challenge is that we don't really know, or we really don't have the data behind to assess the damage, both for female and male workers, right? We really don't know what is behind these programs yet. And I think we are going to be able to see that, you know, once the programs are not in place anymore. But at this point, you know, we are seeing some statistics, but it doesn't really reflect the shadow effects that we have in our economies.
Yeah, and I think in COVID, during a pandemic, during a lockdown or quarantine situation, it's hard enough to collect data under normal circumstances, but even more so, more challenging when there are limitations in physical movement and so on and so forth. I'm going to turn now to Gina. You have done some work within Mazars, but also with other organizations in your network when it comes to supporting women in the financial community and promoting diversity there. So what can we learn from your experience there, and how can we connect that to all this discussion that we've been having around the pandemic and its effects?
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear, you know, from the public policy side, as well as from Qatar side with those ESG activities. Mazars has been in the forefront of doing business for good. And we've also been active in the ESG space as well as diversity as a strategy. We have developed solutions which we believe will help organizations gain insights into the state of their diversity efforts. So just to give a few examples of these solutions, we have the Diversity and Inclusion Risk Analysis Tool, and this really assesses the risk areas at each stage of the employee life cycle. So from attraction to retention to promotion and exit. We also have the Governance Assessment Tool, which analyzes different variables that's embedded in an organization's governance structure, right? So it talks about controls, the attitudes, and ways of how decisions are being made by the leadership team in an organization, which we also consider to be important. We also have the Diversity Predictive Tool. And by the name itself, it predicts the future recruitment and promotion ratios of the company. And that's based off on the current as well as historical employee data and salary information. And also in this tool, it has an automated module that generates a gender pay gap report. So at Mazars, we try to develop solutions because we want to address the problem in the right way. And as Fernanda and Qatar mentioned earlier, data is very important. And hopefully, you know, we are able to provide information to these companies so they can make meaningful decisions as they address those diversity efforts that they're doing. Also in my neighborhood here in New York, the firm is actively involved, and we're supporting diversity and inclusion groups, not just internally, but also outside as well. So for instance, we are very active in our local state societies, the New York State Society and other societies that we have an office in. And we have someone from Mazars who is involved in those committees, specifically the Diversity and Inclusion Committee. We monitor their activities, we support their programs, and we send, you know, we have our women attend those events. So as you know, as an organization, we have a long way to go, just like I think everybody else, but we try our best to make progress along the way.
Thanks, Gina. And that weighs into the next part of the discussion. So we've talked about wide-ranging solutions, what we can expect from the public sector and from governments, what investors can do, what community groups can do, what companies can do. The next part is I want to talk about our own specific organizations internally in your own firms or institutions. What are you doing, or what has worked in your view in terms of promoting gender equality, diversity, and inclusion? What are you doing in your organizations, and is it helping you craft more diverse or inclusive policies and products? Maybe we can start with Ratna.
Thanks, Kat. So at the IMF, as you can imagine, it's traditionally been a very male-dominated and a white male-dominated institution for a very long period of time. And so about, you know, two decades ago, and I've been here forever, women started, you know, ground up fighting for greater equality. And I have to tell you that we did a lot of study, you know, with data, empirical evidence, because that's what economists That's how you can convince the economists, let's say. And we made some progress, but the real progress is coming when the top leadership sends the signal. So we've had now two female managing directors, and we've seen a lot of changes, you know, in terms of promoting women, recruiting women, and increasing, you know, diversity training, which has now become mandatory for us. I think the way in which you can achieve diversity goals, we also have a diversity advisor in an office now. You've got to work both from the top and the bottom. So, but we still have a long way to go. Right now, we are also working on race issues. I recently wrote an article on race and economics, and it was the first time that the IMF published anything on race. But coming back to the COVID crisis, so that's at a general level. What we have done is, again, very sympathetic top management, listening to the concerns, especially of women with small children. It affects both parents, for that matter. So we've become much more flexible in terms of providing child care, both financially during this lockdown period, but also trying to find physical locations of daycare for them. So that's one. Maternity leave during this period has been extended, and this will likely stay beyond COVID. Of course, flexible workers, many of the departments are imposing breaks during the middle of the day. You know, no meetings should be held. Another one is, you know, constant check-in from managers. We've got a lot of examples of virtual mission fatigue. You know, in our job, we travel a lot, and that's very much a huge integral part of the work we do in order to be effective with the authorities in the member countries, to build traction, to build relationship. A lot of it is building relationship. You can't do it all virtually.
But what did you say that having, you mentioned that the IMF has had two female managing directors recently. Would you say that having a diverse leadership team helps craft those more diversity conscious policies, if I should call them that?
Yes. And you know well, Kat, that, you know, the studies I've done cross country actually show that if you have more women at the top as CEOs, when we looked at financial firms, they were only 2%. Globally, which was shocking, as CEOs. And then if you looked at the board of both bank boards, commercial bank boards, and regulatory authority, on average around the globe, there were less than 10% of women. And what we found is that if you increase diversity, increase the share of women, it actually helps improve financial stability, you know, a big goal of these.
Fernanda, from the central bank's perspective, actually this is something that OMFIF has been doing research on. We did a survey earlier this year on what kind of diversity policies different central banks have. I'm very glad that the Central Bank of Brazil participated in that study. Could you give us some insight on what the central bank is doing? You've touched on some of them earlier, but perhaps maybe focus on the workplace and the work environment you have and how that's helping you in your work.
When you look at the employees of the Central Bank of Brazil, you see, you know, economics is a very much male-dominated profession. And interestingly enough, you know, this gender imbalance that you see in the profession is reflected almost perfectly in the gender imbalance that we have inside the Central Bank of Brazil. So if you look at some universities here in Brazil, you see that about 25-ish percent of the master degrees in economics are given to women. And when you look at the statistics here inside the Central Bank of Brazil, you kind of see that same share of, you know, women as a workforce, but also at the different layers of leadership as well. So for the first time, for example, we have two women at the board at the Central Bank of Brazil, myself and my colleague Carolina. So I think this has been a good development for the bank. But, you know, internally, we are very much aware of the challenges that minorities face and women face in the profession. And we want to make sure that we provide an equitable and safe work environment for minorities in general. You know, talking a little bit more about women in economics and how it works here at the Central Bank, we have promoted internally a series of workshops on harassment, discussions about gender problems and gender issues that may arrive in our profession. And as I mentioned before, you know, we launched a new dimension in our strategic agenda inside the central bank, which is the sustainability agenda that has, you know, not only climate related policies, but also policies related to mitigating social risks. And that goes straight into the conversation that we are having here. So this is a topic that we are very much aware of and very worried about, and working very much so to promote an equitable workplace in Central Bank of Brazil.
Yeah, there are some very important points there. I mean, the ESG point about how when people talk about ESG, they quickly think about climate, but actually it's a whole range of issues and challenges that are under this wide umbrella. Qatar talked about some of those things earlier, but Fernando also touched on another important aspect of work environment and workplace atmosphere, which is creating safe spaces for our teams, for our colleagues. And in the study that OMTIF did earlier this year, one of the things that we asked central banks was whether or not they have a set of guidelines, a codified set of policies around discrimination or around dealing with discrimination and harassment in the workplace. So I'm going to move over to Kautar. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about what Barings is doing internally to support your female colleagues and making sure that our workplaces are inclusive and diverse.
Yes, it's tricky because I have a small hesitation to feel a bit indecent in answering the question. Why? Because I feel very privileged. I work in an organization that has been doing a lot of work to support women for some time. We have a Barings Women's Network. We have panels on this. We have very good conditions in terms of maternity leave and child support. We have, we can work remotely without it affecting, at least on my side, affecting much my ability to contribute to the team and to my job. I have a very supportive boss. You know, it's tricky. One thing that
I think the answer is in all of those. The answer is in all of those things that you're describing: supportive mentor, supportive programs within your institution. Like, you know, as you progressed in your career, what would you say was the one most effective thing that helped you get to where you are? I know there are many.
Yeah, sure. No, but before that, I want to say something anecdotal that I think I appreciated a lot at Barings. I don't know if it's true in all Barings offices, so this is a disclaimer, but something anecdotal. I know that there are some colleagues, for instance, who are less able to do their jobs remotely. You have the assistants. When we don't travel as much, you know, they don't have travels to book or expenses or to process or these type of things. You have cleaning teams. You have people working at the reception in the offices who, for the most part, were closed for a long time. And I was very, I felt very, I don't know, heartwarming for me to see that a lot of these people kept their jobs. And, you know, people at the reception or assistants are often women, you know. So this is something that I saw anecdotally among my colleagues that I appreciated a lot from Barings. And that adds on top of everything that is shinier and more fashionable about having, you know, all the support system or the mentoring, all the, you know, the initiatives that are more visible. Related to your specific question, I think one thing that helped me maybe is the fact that I never felt discriminated even inside my own family. And so sometimes, you know, I grew up in Morocco. You have the cliche view from outside that a African or an Arab or a Muslim country might be more conservative, or, you know, that there are more discrimination or prejudice against women. I have never felt treated differently in my own family. And I think it gives somebody a little bit more confidence, you know, to just go for the right degree or apply to the job that maybe you would auto-censor yourself from applying to or reaching for.
Thank you, Kautar. You make a very important point that sometimes, as with many things, it all starts at home. And if we have a supportive environment at home, that's something that the members of our household carry elsewhere. Something I will add, though, before asking the question is that indeed, it is very important to have support from management. The reason that OMPEP has been able to do events like this, discussions like this, research like this, is because it's support from male and female officials within the organization who have supported this project and the events that we do related to it. So will COVID-19 lead to a generation of male-dominated jobs as firms are cutting on expenditure, cost, and overheads, which could mean displacing some female workers?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we're seeing this time is that we are pretty focused on gender diversity, and we are now looking into more in-depth data in terms of the impact of this pandemic, you know, between men and women. And hopefully with that information, we are able to target specific solutions. So that issue that men will have more opportunity in the future will hopefully likely not, you know, not happen. And there will still be a continuous gender balance as we move towards that goal. Because we've done a lot of progress throughout, you know, the past few years, and we risk losing that, especially in this situation. So I think with this discussion that we're having, our proactive, you know, outreach to different government groups, you know, they will be able to focus on those. And I also just want to add on to what Qatar mentioned earlier, that, you know, she felt that she had that community and that support from her family, right? And that's great. And I think that's one of the things that we need to look into. What about those families that don't have that opportunity to belong in those kind of situations? What if those families don't have the necessary support? They don't have the resources. I think that's how IMF and, you know, government agencies can really focus into implementing certain programs that will help these young children, men and women, boys and girls, to have that opportunity, to have more education, to probably, you know, enroll in economics, because right now it's a very, you know, it's a male-dominated degree. You know, those are areas where focus from people who can do something, you know, should be given to.
That's a really important point. Yes, we might be all women in the panel today, but this is definitely not a conversation just for women. Men have to be part of the solution. I will give the final word to Deputy Governor Fernanda. Parting thoughts and most important thing you'd like to highlight.
I will approach your question from two perspectives, from an institutional perspective and then from a personal one. From the institutional side, I think what Ratna said is really important. I think we have an opportunity to include women and minorities in general with technology. And we have been trying to advance this in our institutional agenda, and we think this is key for a future that is more inclusive. So I think this is, it's an opportunity in our hands. There is a lot of low-hanging fruit out there. And, you know, doing banking with our cell phones is, it's just so easy right nowadays, right? So we can actually reach a lot more people now with technology, and we should take advantage of this. Now, from a personal perspective, you know, you can ask what has been important in our lives in terms of, you know, developing at some point in this profession. And I think it's something that we need to do in, like, ourselves, is to look back and think about what helped us through our way. I'm pretty sure in this panel there has been people that had help from the family, people that had no support from our families whatsoever, but still we are in a very privileged positions in our institutions, right? And I think it's our duty to ourselves and the society to do the same. Think about, and was really important in myself, for example, I think I had amazing mentorship throughout my career that was key for making me develop as an economist in a male-dominated world. And what I want to do is to give back and do the same to people around me, right? So I think this is our duty to help our profession to include women and promote a more inclusive work environment for women and other minorities. So I mean, it comes with the territory, basically.
Thank you, Fernanda, for closing on such an inspiring note. Fernanda, Ratna, Gina, Kautar, so wonderful for you to join us. Thank you for supporting this initiative of UNFIS.